Today's guest says, "I am a label, minimalized knowingly and unknowingly by close friends, associates, and worst of all, advocacy professionals." We're going to find out more about her views on this issue in just a moment. But right now, I'd like to let you know that I'm Pamela Brewer, and I'm very happy to welcome you to this edition of Mind Talk. Today's guest is Bukola Oriola, and she is a Nigerian-American journalist, a survivor of trafficking and domestic violence in the suburb of the Twin Cities, Minnesota. You don't often think about trafficking as happening in America. Many people don't, although it certainly does, and certainly not in Minnesota. I am very pleased to welcome Bukola Oriola again to this edition of Mind Talk. Bukola, how are you? Welcome.
I'm good. Good morning. Good day. Thanks for having me here today.
Bukola, it is really wonderful to talk to you now. Some people may remember that you were a guest of Mind Talk many years ago. But I'm going to ask you to tell listeners today a bit about how you came to be trafficked in Minnesota, so far away from your homeland.
Well, thank you so much for the question. It happened as a result of fraud. I came to this to work as a journalist. However, before I came, I had been married in a traditional way to a Nigerian who lived in the U.S. and lived in Minnesota at the time. And they invited me to Minnesota from New York because New York was where I came to work to cover the United Nations 60th anniversary and General Assembly. So coming to Minnesota was originally just to visit and then go back home for him to come home for us to take the traditional marriage to court, for me to come and join him later on. But that didn't happen. Instead, I was asked to stay. I stayed, and for the next 2 years, it was living in hell and in slavery where I was working, and it was taking the money, and I suffered all kinds of abuse, physical, psychological, emotional, and on top of it, as someone who was a journalist, independent, had a career, and was doing my own thing, and was able to take my own pay and do whatever I like with it, I found myself reduced to nothing, where I was working and I couldn't use that money. Now, of my own will to do whatever I wanted.
You said that you were married in your tradition. What was that tradition? How did that marriage occur?
Okay, the tradition in my country, we have different cultures. So my culture and tribe is the Yoruba tribe and Yoruba culture. And the traditional marriage basically means family members getting together to agree that they are giving their kids away for marriage. So the bride's family and the groom's family will come together and have a ceremony. However, that ceremony is done in different ways. Some are very elaborate, and it could take more than one day, and some are just really quiet and simple, that would just be a couple of hours. So mine was the quiet and simple one. Plus the marriage, where at the time, he only called in. He wasn't even there physically present. Only his family members were present. And that happens also in Nigeria now, that people are migrating all over, sometimes both the bride and the groom are not present at such ceremonies. Only the family will be present. So the traditional marriage basically is kind of a family agreement. So For us, the traditional marriage is very important because even if you marry and you don't do the traditional, in some cultures, you are not regarded as married by the family.
I see.
You are not accepted into that family. So there are people who, after getting married for years, perhaps they met abroad and they decide to go to court abroad and marry. After several years, they go back to Nigeria and do the traditional. In fact, a couple went back maybe a few years ago to Nigeria after getting married for over 15 years.
Oh my.
And the man was saying, oh, it's costing me like millions of naira to even bicycle for my five children
Huh.
to go marry my wife in the traditional way. So the tradition is something that is cultural and is something that is rooted in the different cultures.
So when you were married to your husband, had you met him at that point?
No, I'd not met him face to face. I'd
Okay.
only talked to him on the phone,
Okay.
and I've exchanged emails, and I've seen his pictures, I've sent my pictures, and he was calling me every day or almost every day for hours, for almost a year or about a year before we actually no, it was more than a year because we had met around February, I think, the previous year. And we didn't do the traditional until around, was it August or May or June? Well, we didn't do the traditional until much after a year.
Okay.
And at that time, you know, I'd met his family members. His family knew me, and my parents needed to know his family. So they agreed to have the ceremony so that each family can know each other and then agree.
So
And it was documented.
clearly, the integration of families is critically important in your culture.
Yes.
And you had been living in Nigeria for 6 years as a journalist, covering education in Nigeria when you came to the United States on a work permit to cover, as you said, a meeting of the United Nations General Assembly.
Yes.
And since your husband was here, there was no reason for you not to agree to go to him where he was living.
Yeah, actually, you know, the initial plan was that he would come visit me in
Ah.
New York. Yes, that was the initial plan, that he would come visit me in New York, but he changed the plan and said, oh, he had funds issue, low fund issue, and change it. He didn't come. Instead, he asked me to come over. So when I came, he begged me to stay. I said no. I was adamant at first. Then he followed me to New York because I had an aunt in New York, and he also had a cousin in Connecticut that he had not seen for over a decade, I think,
Okay.
at that time. So he followed me to New York, and we both went to Connecticut. And the cousin too begged me that, you know, his brother needs to start a family, and since we already did traditional marriage, I should just stay the court marriage. We can go to court here and do court marriages just for documentation, and I could continue my career as a journalist. And he did take me to some events to cover some events in the Nigerian community, and bought a brand new desktop computer and said, you know, you can still do your work here and file your stories. So I was filing stories back home. And then my aunt too, she said, you know, I think you should stay because you're already married to this man. You know the culture. You're already married to this man. So what are you going to do in Nigeria? Yes, your work, you can continue with him. He has promised to do the necessary things. So just stay with your husband. So I had to call my father and tell him what was happening. And he agreed too, you know, because he had given me to this family as their wife. So everything at that time didn't look abnormal, but I was surprised when things began to change for the bad.
So again, the critical importance of family agreement between your family and your husband's family, that was already in place and already quite powerful. So your moving in with your husband made complete and perfect sense.
Yes.
When you first arrived at your husband's home, how were you treated?
Oh, I was treated like the queen of Nigeria. He was really nice to me. And for the first few weeks or the first few months, everything seemed okay and normal. And he just told me to be patient, that things will fall in place one after the other. And him getting a brand new computer for me to be able to work assured me of my career. And I thought, okay, no problem. I will keep working and filing, you know, some of the stories I still had to write from the United Nations. And also him taking me out to cover the Nigerian community gave me some hope, and everything seemed fine. But when I noticed that things changed was when I became pregnant.
And how quickly after you moved in with your husband did things in fact begin to change?
I found out I was pregnant in the spring, so I'd come in the fall of the previous year of 2005, and then in the spring, around February, March or so, because I remembered it was still snowing. The
Ah.
first time I found out that something was really not right, because I think that there had been some things happening, but I didn't take cognizance of it.
Okay.
I didn't think anything of it. So, for example, one of it is his friend had visited us during Christmas, and the friend was like, "Wow, Bukola, you don't have winter jackets." Because I was wearing a jacket. That jacket I was wearing was a jacket I had bought when I went for a multimedia and online journalism training in Germany
Okay.
while I was still living in Nigeria. So that was the jacket that I had on me. He said, "This is not a winter jacket. This is a like a fall jacket." And really, when I went to Germany, it was during the fall, and that was where I bought that jacket. So he said, "This is a fall jacket. This is not a winter jacket. And Minnesota is really cold." So he took me to the store and bought me a jacket.
Okay.
This same man, you know, noticed that I didn't have the proper clothing on during winter, and said, "Bukola, this shirt, I've only worn it like two or three times. You can have it."
So it
And I
sounds
still
like.
have those two till today. Yeah, so those were I would say like the red flags, but at that time I didn't pay any attention to it. I didn't think anything of it until he was sick and we were at the hospital. And I found out that I was pregnant. And at that hospital was where I really kind of really say I experienced my first kind of punishment for me, you know, when I first recognized it. Like, this is not right, you know. I'm there just newly pregnant, and I couldn't eat, or I didn't have food to eat. And even though he was there on the sick bed, where he could have died, I was the one who rescued him from dying in the bathroom. Yet, he couldn't tell the nurses, "Oh, please help me feed my wife. when I was begging the nurses for food, he was angry at me that I was begging the nurses for food, that why should I be asking the nurses for food? And I was like, I'm hungry. You know, I'm really hungry. And one time I went to, it was a McDonald's. I didn't know how cold it was. I didn't know about frostbite. And that was what when I got my first frostbite too. Because I walked about a mile from that hospital to the McDonald's to get a sandwich. And that time too, I didn't know the sandwich, which one to buy, what it was like. I just got there and just said, you know, I looked on the board and looked and looked and looked. After a while, I just picked one. I was like, it's food. I will just eat it. I don't care what it tastes like. And could you believe that by the time I walked back to the hospital, I couldn't eat the food. The food was cold. Not only was the food cold, I started itching all over. I thought I was going crazy.
So you're pregnant. I mean, your husband was in the hospital. You're pregnant.
Yes.
And
yes.
He's not allowing you to eat in your home.
Yes.
He's not allowing you to ask for help. At home or at the hospital.
Yes.
Did things get better or worse after that?
It got worse. After that, it just, things continued to deteriorate. And, you know, I sometimes go to church because sometimes it will take us to church. And when we went to church, it will, I will see African American women or African women and tell them that I could braid hair. And they will ask for my number and come to the house to braid hair. And then I will braid their hair. So they will braid hair and go. And while I was doing that, it was taking that money. At first, I didn't think anything of it until I found out that, you know, I'm braiding hair and I'm pregnant and the stomach is growing and I can't even buy maternity clothes for myself.
So he isolated you in every way.
Yes.
You didn't have clothes to wear outside of your home. You didn't have food to sustain yourself inside of your home. And when you did earn money, he took that money from you.
Yes.
Did you tell anyone what was happening?
My aunt. Because also, you know, I didn't know there was kind of any help available or knew exactly what I was going through or what it was called. I just thought that, oh, this is kind of a family issue. And back home, most of the time, when there is an issue with the family or the couple, you call a close family member that you think can talk with both of you to resolve whatever issue was going on. So I called my aunt in New York and told her what was going on. And she called him. But it happened that whenever she called him, he would just tell all kinds of lies. And in fact, there was a day my aunt called him. And after speaking with him, my aunt told me, oh, Bukola, this man is very manipulative. She said, if I wasn't talking to you a lot and know what was really going on, I wouldn't believe you. I would have just believed him.
How long did this go on, Bukola?
2 years.
2 years.
Yes.
2 years of being kept in your home, really kept away from your family, not allowed to keep any monies that you earned. 2 years.
Yes.
Bukola, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to move forward a bit in time and find out how you're doing today.
Okay. Thank you.
Folks, stay where you are. This is Pamela Brewer. I'm having a conversation with Bukola Oriola, who is the author of several books. But today we're talking about A Living Label, an inspirational memoir and guide by Bukola Oriola. before we talk about what your life is like today, I'm going to ask you to tell our listeners how you were able to get away from the circumstances that you've just described.
Thank you. I was able to get away through the help of a public health nurse. So this nurse had been visiting me at home when I was pregnant, and I had applied for the WIC program. And when I was doing that application, I was asked if a public health nurse who visits me at home, and I said yes. So the nurse was visiting me every month. And when I had a baby, she continued to visit me. So when the time came for me to reach out for help, I reached out to that public health nurse. And what made me actually reach out to her was because it was threatening me with immigration and with police, because it didn't change my work visa to a spousal visa. It didn't do all the things it promised. So he used that constantly to threaten me. And he actually put his threat to work by calling the police on me one weekend. So that made me to cry out. And even crying out, I didn't know who to cry to. I was just lucky that a client came to do her hair, and I was crying. She asked me what happened. I told her, and she said, oh, you know, your doctor can help you. So call your doctor. And I said, my doctor is far away in Minneapolis. I can't drive. I don't know how to get to Minneapolis. So I can't get to my doctor. And she said, but that's the person that can help you. And then I thought about the public health nurse. I said, well, the nurse comes to me. Let me call the nurse. She said, call the nurse. So I called, and the nurse came. And after telling her what had been happening, she brought out an orange card from her bag and underlined Alexandra House. It's a Better Women's Shelter, because the card happens to be like a resource card in the county. And asked me to call them right away. Yes. So I called, and they gave me an appointment to come in the next day. So I had to kind of plan my escape for the next day with the baby. And that was how I got out of the situation. And
how were you able to actually come in the next day, given that your husband had pretty much removed all your options for freedom?
It was a miracle. So what had happened was that the next day, while I was there thinking about how I'm going to get out of this situation, a customer called me and said, Bukola, I'm in your area fixing my car. Do you need a ride?
Wow.
At this time also, he had opened a business in his name and a shop where I was going to break sale. So she said, do you need a ride to the shop? I said, yes. And she came. So because she came, I couldn't take much. I just carried the baby's diaper bag so that I don't also make her suspect anything. So she took us to the shop. And luckily, the advocate at the shelter had told me the bus number to call to get to the shelter. So I called the bus line, and they told me where to go, because luckily also where the shop was in downtown Anoka, and told me where to go. So I went, and that was how we escaped.
That is extraordinary. And today, what is your life like today? What are you doing today?
Oh, Lord. Today, I'm grateful to God. Now, I'm not only helping with advocacy and helping women in similar situations, but I'm also helping to empower women. I'm helping survivors to build their lives back. I'm helping survivors to heal from their trauma in different ways, either in a non-clinical way or in addition to clinical if they're going through clinical. So I'm really grateful because now, I'm helping survivors to realize that what happened to them does not have to keep them down forever. They can turn around and build their lives back. And they don't have to let anything hold them back. In fact, just yesterday, I did a workshop with a university for survivors on
Wonderful.
entrepreneurship. And one of the questions that were raised was that, oh, some survivors have felony, and they can't get a job. Would that also be a barrier to this entrepreneurship? And I told them, no, it's not going to be a barrier to entrepreneurship. And you can build your life back. So now I'm helping survivors to see that beyond having a voice, because it's one thing to have a voice, it's another thing entirely to thrive.
Yes.
If you have a voice and you are not thriving, when you are speaking, it will be like making noise. But when you are thriving in addition to your voice, you will be turning life around and you will be turning your community around. And that is what I'm doing today, and that is my goal
You
to
heard
continue with in the future.
Me share a quote with our listeners at the beginning of today's conversation, in which you say, "I am a label minimalized knowingly and unknowingly by close friends, associates, and worst of all, advocacy professionals." What do you mean by that?
Thank you. That is a very good question. And yes, I said that, and it's true. It's still true up to today. From my experience, I realized that people tend to forget that I'm a human being. They just think I'm a thing. And that's why I have the title of that book as a living label. I'm constantly labeled. And I realize that it's not just me, it's all the survivors. Where a survivor will sit in the room with other people, and the survivor will be reduced to the experience of the survivor. The survivor's intellectual property will be ripped off. The survivor's confidence will be ripped off in the room as if, oh, you're just a survivor. Just your story is, your story. A survivor can offer more than her story. I turned around to go back to college here in the US and earn the bachelor's degree. Yet, when some people want me to come and speak, they don't think I should be paid to speak. Or they think, oh, we just want to hear your story. Like, do you know that if there is time to put in, there is effort to put in, and it's not just my story. I'm doing more than just my story. I am helping to provide recommendations, suggestions to help with policies, including federal policies. It takes some knowledge and skill to do that. So how
Absolutely.
come you don't see the skill? You just see the victim. I have others who will ask me some questions, and it just comes across like, oh, it's because of my experience. It's very hurtful. And it's important for people to know this and also know how to relate with survivors. Some people don't do it intentionally. They don't even know that that is what they are doing.
How
And I saw.
should one relate to a survivor?
Thank you. How to relate to a survivor is, first of all, in your behavior to that person, behave like you are talking to the person, not focusing on the experience of the person. And if you know that the experience is what you want to get some insight from and information to guide your work, then you want to tell the person to share their experts.
So
And for example,
acknowledge that there is expertise that you are asking that individual to share.
yes, and you can say as a subject matter expert. So being a survivor make that person a subject matter expert. So the person will even share examples, and it could be examples from our own story, but might not necessarily say, this is my story. Because some survivors just want to continue to move on without even referencing their stories. It's a lifetime trauma that you have to live with. And people don't know this.
You shared the experience of being asked to lecture, and one of the people there was so happy that you were doing it for free. And while you're sitting there trying to figure out how you're going to get your next meal, they're telling you how much money they raised as a result of your lecture.
Yes. Yes. And that was, that was painful. And that is where also I say, we're advocates because the person who was talking is one of the board members of a nonprofit organization. So I'm like, okay, you were using my story, you're using me to make money, and you were happy because you are taking a salary home. But the caller is not happy because she doesn't even know how she's going to get the next meal or how she's going to feed a young child.
It's a powerful reminder of what many of us in this society have a tendency to do. I would say often when the person is a female person.
Yes.
You are determined to educate Nigerian youth about the danger of human trafficking. Why is that?
Yeah, I'm determined because I think when people have knowledge, it will really help inform their decisions or their actions. And that will help a lot of them from becoming victims. I've had people ask me questions, and as a result of my answers to them, it has helped them make informed decisions. And going back to Nigeria is one of the questions that I get repeatedly in different ways. In fact, from the first time I gave a public presentation, somebody asked, what are you doing to take your story back to your home country? And it took a long time for it to happen, but I'm grateful that it eventually happened and I was able to go to Nigeria to do the human trafficking awareness. And it reached a lot of Nigerian audience, both at home and abroad. And I was able to reach over 20 million people in 1 week
That's
with the
amazing.
help of the U.S. consulate. And they got, both national and international media in to cover it. And for weeks, people were watching it in the news in various countries. I got a lot of questions from as far as Australia, among the Nigerian communities in Australia. So there were people even calling my family members back home in Nigeria from other countries who knew me or knew my family member and said, oh, we just saw your sister on TV. So that was very, very helpful to putting the information out there and helping the Nigerian youth, because I believe that the youth, and that was why I focused on universities and polytechnics, because the students in higher institutions, they occupy a unique position. And one thing I've realized is that students behave the same. I haven't gone to higher institution in Nigeria and going to two in the US. I saw that, students, they're just the same. Whether the student is 19-year-old or is 59-year-old, once they come together, they can form a powerhouse. So I thought they are in the middle. They can take it up to, corporations and those in top seats and help those people to understand this issue more. And they can also bring it down to the young ones, the high school, the secondary schools, the primary schools or elementary schools, and help them to understand what is going on. So I thought this target audience is the perfect target audience to help create awareness for the purpose of prevention.
And prevention, as we know, can save lives, many lives.
Yes, and it's also costless.
Indeed. I'm curious about the reaction of your family and your husband's family when you returned home to Nigeria, for the trip that you've just described. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, that's where I'd like to pick up. And I'm just going to remind our listeners that I am speaking with Bukola Oriola, who is the author of A Living Label. It is not the only book, it is not the only piece of writing that she's done. You heard me identify her earlier as a journalist, but it is the conversation that we're focusing on today, A Living Label, an inspirational memoir and guide. We will be right back to our conversation with Bukola. Cola, when you talked earlier about the importance of the two families coming together, that indeed the families are considered so important that the families actually can have the marriage before the couple actually meets. So when you returned home to Nigeria with your story and with your teachings, and letting people know what you had experienced, what kind of response did you get from your husband's family, and what kind of response did you get from your family?
Okay, so let me start with my family. With my family, I got a lot of support
Great.
because they already saw what happened. And in fact, it was one of my siblings who saw my picture first while I was still going through the experience and asked, "What happened to you? You don't look okay. You don't even look like you are in the US. You look better when you were in Nigeria." And I couldn't tell him much other than, "I'm not doing too good here," but I didn't say much. And then when my first book came out in prison, And they read it, you know, they were able to understand better what I went through. Then also in the process of getting help, when I got to the shelter, we had to file order for protection. And we went to court. We had this court war for weeks. And during that time, going to court, you know, at that time, families in Nigeria knew what was going on. So his family knew, my family knew, not the entire thing that was going on, but they knew something was not right. And in his case, his family member were calling to threaten my father, one of the sisters, I think. But after, was it after a year? My father passed away. So when my father passed away, because also with the family, they will relate with the adult or the parent in the family or the head of household.
I see.
So in my case, the head of household was my father, and my father had passed away. So there was nobody else for them to relate with or to contact or to call. So that tie was cut. And when I went home to Nigeria, I didn't meet with them.
You did
I was
not.
only there for, I
Okay.
did not. I was only there for 10 days. And those 10 days were 10 days of working hard. You know, I was going, and jumping the plane and came back. Even when I went to Nigeria, you know, it was very hurtful to me that I'm going to do this enormous amount of work. But I couldn't even get to my own father's house because there was no time. It was just to go do that work. And that was what I went to do. So now I will be planning a different trip where I'll be going to Nigeria. It wouldn't be to do any work. It will just be to meet with my family and spend time with my family and also be able to have some closure with my father at his gravesite.
Was your husband prosecuted for anything?
Unfortunately, no. And that is one of the challenge in the court system. Although now they're taking trainings and learning more, but at that time, you know, there was little knowledge about human trafficking and no knowledge about the intersection of domestic violence and human trafficking for the judges to be able to dig further to know what was going on. So he went free because also he had used the law in a manipulative way. So for example, by the time we went to court, I never made one police report, but he made more than one police report against me. Even when I was already at the shelter and running for my life, it was still calling police. So all of those were used against me in court.
You know, it unfortunately is not surprising, but certainly the fact that you would be a foreign born person here in America would put you at more risk. You have no idea what the system is like and what's expected of you and what your options are.
Yes.
For those who are listening to your voice right now, if they are right now in a similar situation, what would you like for them to think about? What can they do?
They can call. There is the National Hotline for Trafficking, which is the 1-888-373-7888. Or they can call our own organization. We are located in Minnesota. And our phone number is 763-273-6624. Or they can contact us via the web at anyton.org.
And can you spell that for us?
Yes, anyton.org is ENITAN. Dot org.
And would you repeat those numbers that you just gave, the hotline
Yes.
and your organization's number?
The hotline is 1-888-373-7888. And our organization's number is 763-273-6624.
I know that education was a very powerful concept in your family, and you have certainly done a great deal to educate people now. Talk a little bit about why education has such a meaningful experience for your mother.
Oh, and you just drew tears out of my eyes because my mom of blessed memory, she didn't have the opportunity to go to school. She only went up to elementary level, and that was it. Because at the time that she was going to school or in our own era, it was the male child era, where the male child is the heir. And as a result, the male child is the one that deserves to go to school. The female child is not going to amount to anything other than become someone else's property or someone else's wife. So my mother at the time was asked to step down for her brother. So her brother went to school while she couldn't continue with her education. And my father, on the other hand, who is the male child now that is, you know, should be going to school, was only able to go up to secondary school. So secondary school would be senior high here.
Okay.
And he too, on his side, his mother valued education, but his father didn't see any value in it. And his mother was the one who put him through school up to that level. And after that, there was no more money to send him to higher education, even though he was very brilliant. And people who grew up with him attested to how brilliant he was and was helping other kids. But they had the opportunity. And because both of them didn't have that opportunity, you know, it worked against them as they tried to struggle through life. And as a result, also, they decided that all their children would go to school regardless of what. And I saw both of them combine forces and resources to ensure that they put us all through school. Trust me, you were spanked if you came back home with bad grades.
Ah.
So you better be coming with good grades. And also, my mom took the time every day when we came back from school, when we were in elementary school, to make sure we were doing our homework and practicing and practicing and practicing. So education was something that was ingrained in us and very important. And I just graduated last summer, having my bachelor's degree. I'm actually the last among my six siblings to among the six children, I have five siblings, to graduate from college. The rest of them, including my younger sister, because we're only two girls, who is 12 years younger than me, had graduated and got a bachelor's since like 5 years ago or so.
You know, I have to say congratulations to you because you went through so much before you were able to actually pursue your own education. Let me switch gears altogether. One day you were at home minding your own business and you got an email that you were pretty clear was probably spam. And it was from somebody saying they were where? Where'd they tell you they were from?
It's to White House, and I was like, oh, this camera's at it again, White House. White House, my foot.
The White House, your foot, right?
Who knew me at the White House? Nobody. You know, this is, you know, some scammers at it again. I'm like, oh, Lord. But then I was curious. So I called my brother, who happens to be a computer engineer and worked with IBM at the time. And he worked with security stuff. So I said, hey, you might have an answer to this dilemma. How do you know if an email is from the place? And then he said, oh, check the details. I said, how do you check details? And then he guided me, and I did. And I looked at it again. I was like, wait, it's from the same place it says it is. And then he asked me, so where is it from? I said, from the White House. He said, then it's from the White House. I'm like, from the White House? And then he asked, what did it say? I said, it didn't say much, just say time to talk. Have questions. And then he said, just respond back and say, ask your question. So I responded back and said, okay, yes, ask your question. I didn't give my information. And then
you still weren't really back. Too sure.
Yes. And then I got another email back. And the person said, oh, yes, you know, we'd like to talk to you about the U.S. Advisory Council on Human Trafficking. And human trafficking was the key word for me.
Yes.
And I was like, oh, yes. I said, this is real. This is real. And I was like, who knew me at the White House? Like, really? How did they even get my information? So the person called, and I told him the same thing on the phone. He laughed and said, oh, yes, those cameras. I tell them the same thing. You can have my card. There is nothing on it. Good luck. So we laughed. We laughed. And he asked me, and I said, yes, I will be honored. And then, you know, this anxiety kicked in, 3 months or so. Anxiety, like, their own timeline is, like, different. They have their own timeline, which is, like, super slow. They tell you, we are moving fast, but that moving fast is super slow for us regular people on the street.
So for them, super fast was 3 months. For you, super fast is tomorrow.
Yes. And then they said, we're going through vetting. I was like, oh, vetting. Yes, FBI, IRS. I'm like, oh, Lord, help me. And, you know, the interview process, though, I will say it was really nice, even though, you know, they disclosed, they were like, oh, it's the attorney. I'm like, okay, an attorney is interviewing me. I don't even have my own attorney. Oh, God, help me. But, you know, when they were asking the questions, I was relaxed. They did such a great work such that you don't feel uncomfortable, even when they were asking you uncomfortable questions. They didn't make you feel uncomfortable. And they just wanted you to be upfront and transparent, which I didn't have trouble doing with them. So that was helpful. But, you know, waiting and don't know whether you will be selected or not, and then you've been told, zip it, don't tell anybody, except your family and friends, and you don't even know who you will tell, because you know, sometimes, you know, you tell your family member something and they blow it up.
Right.
You're scared to tell family members or tell friends. So we just waited until finally they said, oh, congratulations, now you can announce, and they issued the press release. So that was very, very helpful. And I'm grateful for that opportunity. That shows that no matter what you've gone through, there is still hope for you. And that hope message is what I want to bring to survivors, including, you know, everybody generally, because some people didn't go through domestic violence or human trafficking, but they have struggles they're dealing with every day.
Yes.
Or other issues that they've dealt with that almost cost them their lives. Some people have gone through some terminal illness that have just drained them or their family, and, you know, turned people who have been very rich to very poor people because of that. So, you know, to let people know that there is still hope and not to give up. And now I was just reappointed on the council again this year because my 2-year term ended with the former administration. And now with the new administration, I got reappointed. I went through the same process again, you know, the same process of interview and vetting and all of that all over again. And don't share all over again. But this time it was not as anxious as the first time because you already know, you know, the process.
Yes.
It was more helpful to be relaxed and just let it run its course.
Yes.
And also, you know, the timeline is about the same too, you know. We're moving fast, but their own timeline is just different from, you know, our own timeline. But they get the work done. So I'm grateful to be serving again for the second time and hopefully continue to bring the voices of survivors at the top level that will help shape our community in a way that people can live a life free of violence, free of trafficking and exploitation, and even re-exploitation of survivors.
And so for a second time, you were appointed to become a member of the U.S. Advisory Council on Human Trafficking, which is a wonderful honor and an important piece of work that you're doing. We're going to have to take leave of you today. One of the points that you make in your book that I just want to share with the listeners is that you say human trafficking is a multifaceted crime and it can happen to anyone, regardless of status, educational background, career, family, culture, race, age, or gender. That is so critical for us all to remember. Bukola Oriola, author of A Living Label, thank you again so much for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. I'm very grateful.
Well, again, it's a pleasure to speak with you again and to hear about all the wonderful things you're doing. And again, the web address for your organization is enitan.org, yes?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you may choose to do with any professional of your choosing. Mind Talk is available at mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. The Mind Talk app is also free at iTunes and Google Play. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. I'd love to know where in the world you are as you're listening today, so email me with your questions, your comments, your reaction to today's conversation, and let me know where you're listening. And that email address is Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. Again, that's mindtalk.org. I really look forward to hearing from you. And remember always, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. You take care.